All right, turn tonight to Amos chapter 5. We want to finish up chapter 5 and get on into chapter 6 tonight. And these two chapters are concerning the coming judgment, where Amos is trying to wake up these people. He's trying to stir up these people. The fear of God is gone from their eyes. You know, I was thinking today about this matter of the fear of God. You know, we're trying today to stop juvenile crime. We're trying to stop the drug trafficking, especially young folks getting involved in drugs. We're trying to stop the problem with guns and all these things. And of course, as we've said many times, people do not have the key. They've taken away the key, the Lord Jesus Christ. But do you realize that the fear of God is taught? And of course, caught is boys and girls, little folks, grow up in a home. You can teach any child the fear of God. There is not a child that's ever been born that you can't teach the fear of God. It is not something they're born with. They are not born with the fear of God. And it is not something that will naturally come into their lives as they grow older. It will not be there if it is not put there. And I thought about if you could just transform the homes of America and get the parents, of course, the parents have to fear the Lord before they could teach the fear of the Lord, obviously. But the fear of the Lord, now, of course, it grows in a person as their intelligence grows and their experiences grow. But they have to start out with it being instilled into them by their parents. They have to learn to fear their parents before they will ever fear the Lord. And let me say that in no uncertain terms. A child will not fear God. Now, God may work in a way to bring him around to a place of teaching him the fear of God. But the fear of God will have to be taught before he gets saved. Because nobody's ever been saved that didn't fear God. There's no reason to be saved if you don't fear God. Give me one reason to be saved if you don't fear God. You're not going to be saved if you don't fear God. And so the fear of God is taught. It's taught by parents in the home. And the same thing that had happened to Israel had happened to Judah, southern kingdom. It happened also to America. We were taught in the early years of this nation and throughout its history, we were taught to fear God. Boys and girls were raised to fear God. Most people were God-fearing people. They may not have been saved. You don't have to be saved to fear God. I feared God without being saved. But you see, I'm just talking about, not talking about now increasing the number of people that go to heaven. Of course, if people feared God, there would certainly be more people going to heaven because more people would trust Christ if they feared God. But you could stop the majority of the dope problem. You could stop the crime problem of juveniles. You could stop the gun problem. You could stop the whole thing by doing one thing, teaching little children the fear of God. That's the one thing. Just teach little children the fear of God. You know what fear of God does to you? It puts shackles on you. It puts handcuffs on you. You know, you can't do the things that other people do if you fear God. You know God sees you. You know God is in heaven and he's looking down on you. And he sees you. Now, you may not understand all the theology and other things about that and about that God or anything else, but you know there is a God and that God created you and that God is looking down on you and he knows what you're thinking. Now, see, that's what's so wrong about teaching folks. Santa Claus, he, you know, knows what you're thinking. He knows if you've been good or nice. Awful, awful things to be teaching kids. I think I told you the other day about seeing a woman in the store. A little old kid just cutting up and misbehaving and just going crazy. And she was saying to him, now, you know, Christmas is coming and Santa Claus sees you. And if you don't behave, you won't get anything for Christmas. And that's what she was saying, this little kid. She's only got 1 or 2 weeks a year that she has any leverage on. Isn't that awful? If you know God and you're teaching the fear of God to children, you got 52 weeks a year. You can teach them that God sees you. He's beholding you. He's looking at you. He's watching you. And that's the most important thing to be taught to little children, is that to fear God. It's not the most important thing to be taught little children is that I love you. God help us. parents always think they're supposed to teach, I love you, bless you, mama loves you. Yes, mama does love you and let you go to hell just fast as you can go, honey. She's going to drive you to hell just fast as you can go. She's going to love you into hell. That's foolish. Teach them to fear you. Teach them that I'm your mama, I'm your daddy, and you, buddy, when I speak, you hop. All you want to know if I speak is how high do I hop. That's all you want to know. Nothing else. Now, people think I'm foolish with the kind of discipline I teach, but it's God's discipline. If you don't like the discipline I teach, it's because you don't like the way God teaches discipline in the Word of God. You've got a problem with God, you don't have a problem with me. That's where your problem is. Your problem is with God. It's not with me. Because I'm telling you exactly like the Bible teaches and what the Bible teaches about this matter of authority and control and discipline. And the most important thing boys and girls need to be taught is to fear God. And if we had a nation that feared God, the crime rate would disappear. Not totally, obviously, but especially with boys and girls, the younger ones and so forth. Even a person taught to fear God can go against it. Take, for instance, the thief that was hanged by Jesus Christ. Those two thieves were hanged by Christ. One of them feared God. He'd been taught to fear God. And when he was hanging there by Christ, he said to the other thief, whenever the other thief rebuked Christ, he said to him, what are you doing? Don't you fear God? He never asked that question before. They were too busy, you know, doing things that were not right. So there'd be still some crime. There'd be still some need for jails. As long as a man has the old rotten heart, just teaching to fear God wouldn't clean out all of those things, obviously. But I'll tell you what, it would so greatly reduce those kind of problems because boys and girls would grow up knowing that wherever they are, in the bathroom, in their bedroom, hiding with those dirty stories and dirty books that mama doesn't know anything about because she's not smart enough to go look for them. She thinks you're a little dolly dolly, sweet, sweet sugar honey baby, and you don't look at pornography. What foolish mothers we have. What foolish fathers who think that. You're stupid, that's all. You don't know anything about the human heart. Have you never seen yours? See? That's wicked. Their hearts are wicked, desperately wicked. But if they had the fear of God, they'd know God was watching while they were slipping that dirty stuff out from under their bed and reading it and looking at all those things. They'd know God was looking. And they wouldn't be very comfortable. They may still do something, but it wouldn't be very comfortable doing it. Because they'd know God saw them when they did it. Now, this Israel is a nation. This condition in Amos' day was a nation that the fear of God was gone. Now, believing that they were God's chosen had not gone. Believing that they were all right in their condition like they were was not gone. They believed that. They lived in their pleasure and they had their sacrifices and they had their religion and they had all these things and they thought and supposed that they were pleasing to God and that God was satisfied with them, see, because, you see, they didn't fear God. They were not looking into the Word of God. They were not listening to the prophets. And so they had no understanding of how rotten their heart was. See, they had no understanding. Jeremiah lived in this day, and he spoke of how wicked the heart is, deceitful, wicked, corrupt, rotten. And all of our righteousnesses, the good things you do, are filthy rags. Rags that come off of a putrefying sore. That's what the goodness that you think is so nice is to God. Okay? So what do you think that your other bad things are that you might consider bad when in the light of that? Well, this is the time. It was in Israel. And God expresses, beginning in verse 21, I want us to read, God expresses his hatred for the proper sacrifices offered from a heart not right with him. Verse 21, I despise your feast days, and I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Now, God had commanded these feast days. These were not days that were bad days. They were days that God had established and set up, as we read about in Exodus and Leviticus, those feast times that were set up and established and so forth. And they were to have that in the tabernacle, that sweet smell rising up which was the pleasing to God, the odor, the smell of their sacrifices, they was to rise up to God, and God was to be pleased with that. But we find out here that God was not pleased with it. See? Ritual will not please God. Only heart worship and heart service pleases God. You can do all the things you do in the flesh. You can play church in the flesh. You can give in the flesh. You can pray in the flesh. You can do anything religious in the flesh. See? You can do it all in the flesh. God will not be satisfied one bit. You can go to Sunday school and church every day of your life and never miss a day and not please God. Okay? You can give faithfully, tithe and give above the tithe, and you can do all those things and not please God. We got to understand that there's only one thing that pleases God, and that's a humble and contrite heart. It has to come from that. A humble and contrite heart. And so he said, I despise. I will not smell. I'm not going to take a breath while you're offering these things. Now, you know, I'm not going. We have to take a breath to smell. That's the reason I said that. You know, yeah. Now God doesn't have a nose, so He doesn't have to take a breath to smell. But those incense and odors were to come up as sweet smelling savor to Him. But it stunk. It stunk to Him. He said, I'm not going to smell it. Because it stinks, you see. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat or meal offerings, I will not accept them, neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Won't accept any of your sacrifices, not at all. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs. Oh, they were singing songs. For I will not hear the melody of thy viols. Now that's an interesting thing. Look over in chapter 6, in verse 5, and here he's still talking about this same, that chant to the sound of the viol, and invent to themselves instruments of music like David. Now that's an interesting thing, and I made a note or two if I can find that. Yeah, verse 5. This word chant in chapter 6, verse 5, means twaddle, troll, here used of empty, worthless singing. And the verse in 23 that we just read, noise, was the melody that the viols gave off. You see what was wrong in this day of apostasy? Their music was bad. Their music was bad. They were coming with these worshipful songs. Notice it says in verse 5 of chapter 6, and they invented to themselves instruments of music. They made up instruments of music. They said, we're like David. David was the standard in music for Israel, you know, the harp player and so forth. And so they tried to compare themselves to David. And they said, David made music, and he wrote songs, and the songs, he made all this music to be sung. We're doing the same thing. They were writing their courses. They were writing their songs. No telling what kind of beat they were played to. I don't know whether they had rock in that time or just contemporary, but it was contemporary. And God said, it stinks in my sight, just like God says the music of today stinks. If God were writing today concerning the church and today and the kind of music that is brought before Him, the contemporary music, and all the modern sounds that you try to put Christian words to sanctify it, you know, and make it Christian, take the old world's music and everything else and try to put some words to it to make it Christian. God hates that. He hated it then. He mentioned twice in both these chapters about the music of their worship time. And it was noise. Yeah, it was noise. And in verse 5 of chapter 6, it was they were chanting. They were twaddling. Used, as Van Aureli says, used here of empty, worthless singing. Here's what he said about that, Van Aureli. They invent new singing instruments. In other words, to accompany singing, like David, the great master of Hebrew music. But their skill ministers only idle diversion. There's nothing that God appreciates or that God accepts in their music. I think that's interesting in this, that in this time of apostasy, their music was apostatized too. God hated their music just like He hated their sacrifice and their offerings. But now look at verse 24. He says, but let judgment or justice. Many times in the King James, these two words, there's some similarity as far as justice and judgment is concerned. But justice is much better understood by us whenever we say, you know, God wanted justice. He wanted them, they were robbing the poor, they were beating and cheating, taking bribes, they were doing all these things. And that God said, you know, if you want to please me, if you want to do what pleases me, then let justice run down as waters, just like a waterfall flowing over the stream. Let it just reach, you know, just be abundant and full and flowing, not a little puddle, not a little pond of it, but flowing waters, fresh waters, rich waters. Let it flow down, he said. And righteousness as a mighty stream, or this mighty stream means ever flowing. So let justice run down as waters, and righteousness as ever flowing. In other words, flowing down. It doing right. Right relationship with man and right relationship with God. Okay? Justice speaks of relationship with man. Be just in all your dealings, relationship. Doing right. Not just talking, but doing right. See, they were talking. They were doing a lot of talking, but they weren't doing. Now, this was Israel's problem always, even in their trip from Egypt to Canaan. Verse 25 and 26, he says, have ye offered unto me sacrifice and offering in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But ye have borne the tabernacles of your Moloch and Chim, your images, the star of your God, which ye made to yourselves. Now, in other words, even during the wilderness wanderings, when they started offering sacrifice and so forth, they were still mixing it with heathen worship and sacrifices. So they had a long history of idol worship. This was a terrible thing with them. And God had constantly told them that they were special people unto himself and not to be mixed with the nations of the world. That's exactly what he says today to us in the church. Come out from among them, be ye separate, touch not the unclean thing, and I'll receive you. I'll be a father unto you, be my sons and daughters. See, but we have to separate from the world. We have to get away from the world. That doesn't mean that we don't speak to people in the world or you know people or friendship, work with people in the world. But as far as loving the world, as far as thinking like the world, as far as letting the world affect us, and we're to pull out from it. It's not, as we read the other night, it's not to be our playground, it's to be a battleground. Now, therefore, he said, verse 27, will I cause you to go into captivity beyond Damascus. Now, Damascus was in Syria. Beyond Damascus was Assyria. And, of course, it was Assyria that took them into captivity some years later. Now, we come to chapter 6 and the second woe. You remember back in verse 18 of chapter 5, he said, woe to you that desire the day of the Lord. That was the first woe. Those folks who said, we want the day of the Lord to come. The day of the Lord will be a day of judgment upon our enemies. God will destroy our enemies and we will be lifted up and honored and we will be ever in place of blessing as God destroys our enemies. And he said, I got news for you. Amos said, you don't want the day of the Lord. You don't want the day of the Lord. If you were true believers, if you were right in your heart with God, yes, you know, it would be a day of blessing. Because the day of the Lord first is a day of judgment and then blessing. But the judgment is on the unrighteous, and they were included in that. They didn't believe it, but they were. So the Christians today, so the church today. Basically, the church today is included in the judgment that's going to come. But they're looking for a rapture. They're looking for the day of the Lord. They're looking for listen, unless your heart's right with God, unless you're walking in fellowship with him, unless you're fighting the battles of the Lord here upon the earth, don't talk about wanting relief. Because it won't be that for you. It'll be judgment, just like it was for them, if your heart's not right with God. Now, so he said, woe unto them under ease in Zion. This is interesting. Feinberg said about them at this condition, he said, they are resting in a false security engendered by a heartless ritual and worship which they blindly believe will satisfy God. How can you say it any better than that? How could we? Oh, that we could say it to church after church, people all across this nation of America today and around the world, where people are trusting just the same way. They are resting in a false security. There are lots of people teaching eternal security that are not eternally secure because they never have been saved. If you're saved, if you've ever been saved, then you from that point are eternally secure. You'll never be lost. But you know what the bad thing is? There are lots and lots, there are millions of people resting and trusting in eternal security that are not saved. Now, what good is eternal security to them? What good is eternal security to a person who's lost? It's of no value. It's of no good. And yet there are millions today trusting in the fact that I'm under the grace of God. I one time made a profession. I one time joined the church. I one time was baptized. I one time did this. I one time did that. And I went forward and now I know everything's all right. Everything's all right. When there has been no change in their life, they're walking the same way, living the same way, and their heart's the same toward the Lord. Well, that's a sad condition. So this is what he said. They are resting in a false security engendered by a heartless ritual and worship which they blindly believe will satisfy God. They blindly believe it will satisfy God. What a condition to be in. Let me read you verse 1, and I'm going to read it from a different translation. You look at your King James translation, and this is translation by C. O'Reilly. And I'm reading it, his translation. Woe to you that are of cheerful heart in Zion, and that are without care on Samaria's mountain. See, now Zion is Jerusalem. So here's a double condemnation in this verse. The condemnation, we've seen this a couple of times. We saw it once before when he mentioned both nations. Here he's basically preaching to Israel, but he brings in here that they are at ease in Jerusalem too. They're cheerful in Jerusalem. They don't think anything going to happen to them. So he says, woe to them that are of cheerful heart in Zion, that would be down Jerusalem, and that are without care on Samaria's mountain. You see, Samaria was a mountain fortress. I've been there. Maybe some of you have been there. Been there a couple of times to the old side of the castle. They're back up on that mountain. It's not a high mountain as we would think a lot of places are. But the old ruins are there where Ahab's castle was and on till their destruction of Samaria as God pronounced it. But it was a mountain fortress, and it took Assyria 3 years of siege to take it. Syria had great forces, but they couldn't get into that mountain fortress of Samaria. So you can see why they're sitting at ease in Zion, cheerful in Samaria. So verse 1, they're without care on Samaria's mountain. The choice ones of the first fruits of the nations, and to whom the house of Israel is wont to come. The choice ones means the leadership, the kings. They're living in this protected area, and they're without care, and they're the ones to whom the house of Israel is wont to come. They're the ones that the rest of Israel has to come to for judgment. They have to come to them whenever there's a controversy between people, and it's these people that, instead of giving them justice, are taking bribes and are giving them bad justice and so forth. So this is a, I think, says a little better what verse 1 of chapter 6 says. Now, so there, woe to these careless nations, Zion and Samaria, living in luxury and ease while oppressing the righteous and the poor, yet thinking they are in good standing with Jehovah. See, now they've got to get this deception of them. If you don't understand this, they are thinking everything is right. And so this prophet comes preaching this message, and they won't listen to him. Don't come with no prophet message to doom. We aren't interested. We're doing fine. We have our worship, and we worship Jehovah, and we have our worship, and we have our house of worship, and everything is fine. We're fortified. Nobody can take this place. We're secure here in this place. Well, we'll stop there with verse 1 of chapter 6, the second woe, and pick up again, Lord willing, on Sunday.